Welcome to MikeBite. My name's Gavin Clark. I'm software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, the editor of ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog.
And if it's spring, it must be a new version of Windows. And this, in particular, Windows 7 release candidate. The biggest thing that's going to feature in this version of the code is the antitrust button, the thing that lets you deinstall Internet Explorer. Also, this show, we'll be talking about Microsoft and the curse of netbooks. They're both a blessing to the company that helped it through its most recent painful third quarter results. But also, they're not doing it any favours on earnings. But Microsoft does have a plan. However, will that plan work? We're going to kind of get into some of that. And then you might have heard of this database company called Oracle buying this company called Sun Microsystems. Well, people are starting to speculate, what's Microsoft going to do? They surely must buy a hardware company. We don't think so, and we'll tell you why not. So MJ, Windows 7 release candidate, what's going on there with the antitrust button?
You've got to coin that, Gavin, because that is like really something. If you don't trademark it, somebody else is going to.
Already filing a trademark.
This build, everyone's so hyped up about it, and there's so much pent up interest and energy around it. But there's not a whole lot new in it, really. I mean, it's got more performance tweaks. It's got some updates to the code that they've made since the beta came out in January. But there's not any big wow in the RC. So if people are hoping for that, they're going to be a little bit disappointed. The biggest thing is, as you're calling it, the antitrust button, which is a new feature that's being added to this version, and it's definitely going to be in the final, I would say, that lets you remove IE8, media player, basically anything that's got Microsoft in antitrust hot water in the past. So things like Windows Search, Movie Maker, all those kinds of things.
That's pretty broad-ranging, but we've been in it before, haven't they, with the XP versions of Windows for Europe where you could hide or deinstall Media Player. What's really different this time?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot that's really different this time, except I think they're finally figuring out, instead of having all these KLM and OP versions of Windows that no one's buying, why not just kind of head things off at the pass, I guess, and have one big checkbox where if you're a user and you don't want to see some of these features, you can just check them and they'll disappear from view. I mean, it, you know, the real thing to remember here, though, is they're not really disappearing. Like, it's not really removing IE8 from your code. It's just making it so you don't see it and you can have another browser download in its place.
Right. And that's kind of the issue. It's not actually going to take it out of the operating system, is it? It's still going to be there, just you won't be able to see it. And I think you were saying previously that one reason is because Internet Explorer is so kind of like hardwired into the whole operating system. You can't remove it.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft's foes had their chance, like you said, 6 years ago to get Microsoft to remove IE from the browser. And they didn't actually win their fight here in the United States to get that to happen. So once Microsoft had a little leeway there, they really built up Windows as each successive version came out so that it relied more and more on Internet Explorer functionality underneath. So now to just say, okay, why don't they just rip it out? It's really pretty much impossible. They'd have to kind of redo Windows to make it all disappear.
I think Microsoft possibly thought it could make the antitrust decision go away, which is why it kind of trod water a little bit on that. But it's interesting that 7 years later, antitrust is still a big subject as it was back then, at least as far as the Europeans are concerned. And that's where a lot of this has kind of originated from. This hasn't it this time with Opera in particular filing the lawsuit against the company, or not, but at least it's sparking the investigation in Europe. It just shows that Microsoft couldn't make this issue go away. It couldn't just keep building versions of Windows and you know, it would just like, you know, the technology would advance, the lawsuit would kind of like would drag along behind it to the point of irrelevance.
Yeah, I mean, I always wondered if they ever thought this issue was totally going to disappear, because I'm actually catching a lot of heck for this on my blog right now, but you know, it's pretty well known that the EC judges are not friends of Microsoft, and people are like, oh, you have to justify saying that. Well, I don't think there's anybody who would really doubt that. And this is why that case has been brought in Europe. The you know, the US judges have been pretty lenient on what Microsoft's doing, but in Europe that's not the case. So of course, what a great venue for someone like Opera, you know, now with joined in the case by Google, Mozilla, IBM, and the whole ECIS clan. I mean, it's the perfect venue for them to try again to make something happen that they couldn't make happen 6 years ago.
As a European, I have to stand up for Europe on that front. I think the culture is slightly different, and I think you're correct. I think Microsoft's had an easier pass here in the US than it has in Europe as a whole. But then you have to remember that in the US, it's not actually illegal to be a monopoly. The illegality comes if you abuse that monopoly, which is Microsoft was judged to have done. Whereas in Europe, the standard seems to be completely different. It can be a bad thing to have a monopoly, and therefore the whole kind of like, the whole legal, the value system is somehow different. And so I think Microsoft is, if it comes with an American sense of it's okay to be a monopoly, it's going to get undone as it has been.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. You know, the part that always comes back to me, because I'm thinking as an American about this, is, you know, in the U.S., you have to be showing that you abused your monopoly power in a way that hurts consumers. Yeah. And so I think this is where Microsoft always has been able to kind of get around the argument that IE should be bundled, because if you go out and interview the everyday person, do you want your browser in your operating system? They're going to say yeah, because they don't want to have to go download it. And a lot of people don't even know the difference between Windows and the browser. Like my mom, for example, calls IE Windows. Like when I say, Mom, click on IE, if I'm trying to have her fix something, she'll be like, I don't know what that is, you know? So, I mean, to them, it's just one thing. And I think, you know, that's something. It's definitely hurt Microsoft's competitors to be allowing them to bundle the browser into the operating system, but showing that it's really hurting everyday consumers has been trickier.
I think it's hard also because Microsoft has a genuine belief that every piece of work they do on Windows improves what they call the experience. So that they don't see as any problem in bundling Internet Explorer with Windows because they're improving the experience, you know, the integration, the reason you don't have to download separate pieces of software. And there's a good argument for that. But in Europe, you know, people have different kind of like, you know, it goes beyond technology argument. It goes into just the geopolitical argument of, you know, it's American software. It's a big corporation. We don't want their software here. There's more sensitivities involved. And I'm not sure Microsoft or its lawyers have ever fully appreciated that. They thought people would just buy into the, you know, the improved experience argument.
Yep. I didn't know. I learned something new today. Thanks, Gab.
Having said that, you know, I do know that those tech companies that you mentioned, people like Opera, do lobby the European justices. There is lobbying, there is politics behind the scene, you know, and you can see, you know, Europe is a very, very interesting example for an American company trying to sell its software, because the market is so fragmented and you have more than just technology debate. You have very real political debates about whether we should be using this software, especially in places like France and Germany.
You know, I think in the end, what's going to be really interesting about this case isn't so much if, you know, when or if the judges come down on Microsoft or even how much the fine is, but what are they going to make them do as a remedy? Because, you know, okay, they've got this new checkbox in Windows 7 that's going to let you remove IE, quote unquote, around remove IE. But, you know, what Opera's been pushing for is to require Microsoft to, in some way, either electronically or actually by putting the bits on the disk, to distribute its browser and other competitors' browsers. And that's where people are really kind of flipping out, because they're like, wow, should Microsoft have to pay to distribute its competitors' products? Which is an interesting argument, too.
It's an interesting argument. For me, there's a kind of parallel here. But again, Europe has come from a world of extreme regulation. I mean, we were kind of like, we had a lot of state monopolies, especially in telecoms. And those monopolies got broken up years and years ago in many cases. And companies like, for example, British Telecom in the United Kingdom have had to deal with opening up their networks to rival telco companies, and because they own the underlying infrastructure. And I think there's a parallel here between Microsoft. They might own the desktop infrastructure, but they might have to accept the fact they have to open up and let competitors play in that because they are a natural monopoly on the desktop.
Wow. That'll be really interesting for us to be watching over the next few weeks, months. You know, the next big deadline in this case is on April 28th, which when Microsoft's required to respond to the EC, which has already issued its preliminary ruling in the case. it, so April 28th is the date when Microsoft's going to have to respond to the EC judges and their preliminary ruling in this case. And Microsoft's been able to postpone that date a couple of times, so I think they're not going to have trouble postponing it again, and they are going to have to actually come up with some kind of an argument in response to what the EC has already said.
Yeah. And just taking a step back, Windows 7 in general, I think, is an interesting. I think, interestingly, it's pretty much been a job done for a very long period of time, hasn't it? I mean, this has not been the train wreck that Vista was in. There were so many different parts that couldn't be controlled and were up in the air. This has been done and dusted for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I think the release candidate and the shape that it's in is very indicative of that. It's pretty solid. I saw Paul Thoreau, who is a Windows commentator out there, saying, the thing's done. Let's ship it, guys. You know, I mean, people have been saying that since the beta came out in January. And it sounds like from people I'm talking to that, you know, RTM is still a number of months away. But it is pretty much a fait accompli at this point, and nobody's expecting any big changes or any huge features to fall out or pieces not to make it into the final at this point.
I think there's an interesting debate here to be had about, does the Microsoft model of delivering software actually work? Because as you know, that they like to work to very specific product cycles, as any tech company does. But it seems in this case, as we say, the bits are done. The thing that's following on now is lining up the rest of the organization behind the delivery, the sales, the marketing, the promotion, and the integration to the other products. That's possibly the thing that's holding up the delivery of what is really a done operating system, whereas maybe in the open source world, or like say the Linux companies, when they're done, they're done. There's a very short period of time between the final completion, the release candidate, and actual availability product, because those guys don't really bother with the big, huge sales, marketing, promotion, integration machine that follows on behind the delivery of the code, I don't think.
That's a good point. And also, you know, the other step that Microsoft has that a lot of other people don't have is the whole get the code to OEMs and give them time to test it before the launch. And that sometimes, as it did in Vista, it could end up delaying the launch of something that's done for months. Yeah. So, yeah, they're kind of beholden to the OEM community that way.
So, which of course leads on to something that was interesting fairly recently and has some kind of tie into the Microsoft Q3 results, which they recently announced. And it was interesting that CFO Chris Liddell was actually standing up and defending the release cycle for Windows 7 and Office 2010 in the midst of a recession. And he tried to justify it by saying that we're going to launch these products in a period of soft demand so that when the demand actually returns, we will be able to accelerate out of that faster than any other tech company. So Microsoft believes that Windows 7 will help it accelerate fast out of the recession, but I think the jury's still out on that, because Windows Vista didn't significantly impact results, and there was a lot of expectations ahead of that, wasn't there?
Yeah. And then, you know, as you mentioned when we started the podcast here, that the kind of the double-edged sword for Microsoft in all this is netbooks.
Yeah.
And it's currently a bugaboo for them, and it's going to be continuing to be something that they're going to have to weigh how to deal with as they go towards Windows 7. Because as we've talked about in previous episodes of this podcast, you know, Windows 7, all SKUs of it are going to be able to run on netbooks.
Yeah.
I mean, even like the highest end SKU of Windows 7 can work really well on a netbook. But Microsoft is stuck here now because they can't price Windows 7 when they're selling it to netbook vendors at a really high cost, or they're going to leave the door wide open for Android and Linux and other competitors. But if they don't do that, they're really stabbing themselves in the foot, because they're undercutting their own price schedule for Windows, you know, where they make a huge chunk of their Windows client revenues from bundling deals with PC makers.
Well, I thought it was interesting that there was a lot of stuff going around in the last week or 2 weeks or so about the Windows 7 Starter Edition, which was theoretically going to be the version that is designed specifically for netbooks and will only let you run three applications simultaneously. And it's not going to include Windows Media Center, it won't include the Aero interface, and it won't let you set up multiple networks. Microsoft's strategy seems to be, the way it's looking like is It wants to give you a kind of a subset of a notebook by calling it a netbook, and then it wants to upsell the customer into going, well, if I want the full media experience, I'm going to have to buy a notebook, and that's going to run Windows 7 Home Premium. But then, you know, that's kind of forcing the market, and I'm not sure that in a recession, when people have had a taste of goodness on a netbook that does a very good job, they're then going to go, okay, I'll accept a subset of a notebook, and I'll pay more, and then in the long run, I'll want to upgrade to a full notebook. You know, it's an example of Microsoft's kind of SKU madness, where they try to segment the market to suit their own kind of business plan.
Yeah, and you know, something very telling on the recent Q3 earnings call, I thought, which I was surprised nobody really jumped on this as far as follow-ups, but you know, Microsoft admitted on that call that their current strategy of upselling and trying to get people to move up to the premium SKUs of Vista, as they call them, the premium SKUs, is not working right now because of the economy. And their premium SKU sales were way off for Windows and for Office in the third quarter. So what does that say about what's going to happen with Windows 7 if that trend continues? If, you know, they're building their whole business plan around the idea that people are going to be willing to use Windows Anytime Upgrade or some other program on the Office side to move up to a more expensive SKU once they see how crappy the one that they bought was, you know. But what if they aren't willing to do that?
Well, precisely, especially, you know, and that kind of raises two issues. Why would you want to pay a lot of money for a crappy netbook and then go, the one day the light bulb go off and go, I know what, I'll buy the more expensive SKU. I don't think people are going to do that in this kind of economy. People are learning the lessons. And it's always been the story in Microsoft software, especially with Office. You get what's good enough and you don't upgrade with every new version of Office. And Microsoft seems has a great deal of difficulty learning that example. It seems to bolt in completely into this whole idea of upselling people. Kind of one thing. And then another issue, I spoke to Jim Zemlin this week, who's head of the Linux Foundation. I mean, he loves this because, you know, this whole gaming in the market, this kind of artificial kind of like SKUs and versions, basically is going to send people towards Linux, you know, things like Ubuntu, because you get what you pay for, which is like a pretty good operating system. There's no like, okay, we're going to hold these bits back for you to make you buy the more expensive version. And the same goes for Apple. Now, I know Apple had a kind of fairly tough week this week, like MacBook sales were down. But again, you know, and there's been a lot of like, you know, kind of like very kind of spurious marketing claims recently coming from Microsoft on the whole Apple tax. But the fact is, you'll pay probably the same for a PC as you would for a good Mac, and you'll get all the software. They won't try and game you on the operating system.
Well, I won't even go there with you on Apple, Gavin, because it could turn ugly really fast here. But I think, to me, what was telling in Apple's recent results was their, you know, Mac sales were slightly off. They actually did pretty well considering how everybody else is doing right now. Yeah. But, you know, they're holding to the line that netbooks are crap, and we are not going to make crap, so we're not going to make a netbook. I think there's some problems in that if you really want to allow customers to have choice. That aside, the other thing I wanted to say about Microsoft and netbooks that I've been thinking about lately is, you know, everyone's like, oh, you only can use 3 apps on Starter Edition. And I was one of those people who were like, wow, who would want to do that? But the other day I was thinking, what do I use on my laptop every day? I use about 3 apps. I use the browser, I use Word, and I use my email client. And that's pretty much all I use for like most of my day every day. So, you know, because you can only use 3 apps concurrently, you can keep switching off which 3 apps you use. And, you know, the whole purpose that netbooks are made for, or at least they're going to be ideal for, is when there are web apps out there, because you can have, I think, almost unlimited, if not unlimited, tabs open within any of those apps. So, you know, some people are saying it's really going to help Google Docs and all, but Microsoft's got some web apps coming online too. You know, they've got their whole Exchange Online service now, and they've got these Office 2010 web apps coming, which are web versions of Word, PowerPoint, Excel. So, I mean, maybe netbooks will be good enough for everyday people, and maybe it won't be this like, oh, this is just a piece of crap like Apple and some others are trying to say.
Well, it's one thing. I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, I was thinking about this too. I was thinking, how many applications do I run at one time? And I've got a browser and Word open, mostly. But you know, who wants to be told by Microsoft that, hey, we know you run three apps, so we're only going to give you an OS that lets you run three apps at the same time? And people like people have aspirations. They might want to run four apps. I mean,
I see why you go with the EU arguments on things now. You like regulation.
Yeah, I'm such a European socialist, aren't I?
You are.
Doing crazy things like freedom and... not being told what to
but
do.
I mean,
you're okay being told what to do as long as it's a private corporation. As soon as the government gets involved, you people are all like, "Whoa, socialism."
No. I think realistically, like, let's see what people really use netbooks for. I actually have to admit, when Windows 7 comes out later this year, the first thing I'm going to go out and buy is a netbook running Windows 7.
Yeah. So. I also got to say, I think we're in a classic kind of noise tunnel here as well. This whole idea of netbooks going to be running at net apps and stuff, online apps. I mean, it's kind of like, it's again the case, the PC is the PC. It does what it does. The netbook is the PC. It does what it does. You know, people, I really have trouble with people who think they're gonna, like, netbooks are going to open the way to a new set of online applications. The culture, you know, the PC, the culture of the PC is pretty firmly established. People like their applications running locally. Unfortunately, sorry to tell that to a lot of people who believe in the cloud, but
you know,
the netbook is not going to suddenly change the way people think and work.
No, I agree with you. I so agree with you on that. And I think the real way to think about netbooks is as your second or third PC. It's not going to be your main desktop. It's not going to be the only PC that you have.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The other thing we didn't touch on that's not directly related to earnings, but I don't know if you want to go there, is Windows 8.
Oh, I'll go there.
Okay. Because it's so ironic. Right around the time Microsoft's really trying to build the hype cycle up for Windows 7, what happens? There's leaks about Windows 8.
Yeah.
And it's funny. To be fair, because, you know, I try to be fair, even though Microsoft doesn't think I'm...
You got kind of an anti-Microsoft slant. They don't like you. So you write some negative shit about them.
You know, people are like, oh, man, they're leaking stuff on Windows 8. Actually, Microsoft's not leaking stuff on Windows 8 right now. A couple of websites have been trolling their job site and have found them starting to advertise for Windows 8 developers and talking about specific features. So that's where these new leaks are coming from. I think Microsoft's probably going to crack down on their job site pretty soon and password it or something, because you know, they've got to explain what they want people to do for the next generation of software, but they're giving away the farm in a way. So Windows 8, they haven't talked dates, they haven't talked features. You know, the couple of leaks that have happened this week were things about where they're going to go with some of the distributed file caching. The distributed file serving technologies that are going to be in Windows 8 Server. So, you know, we don't know anything big about it. And when I wrote about it on my blog this week, a lot of users were like, oh, no, don't even start talking about Windows 8. I'm still running XP. Like, I don't even want to hear about Windows 8. I'm trying to weigh, should I go to Windows 7? And now you're going to start telling me about Windows 8? So people aren't ready, but here it comes, guys. It's probably going to be in two more years. So I'd say around 2011 or so. I think the reason I thought it was relevant and worth writing about, even though we don't know a lot about it, is, you know, I get a lot of questions about, so I think Windows 7 is the end of the line for Microsoft, right? Like, they're done with Windows after that, or now it's going to be Windows in the cloud. No, Windows 8 is going to be the successor to Windows 7, and it's going to look a lot like Windows 7. So that's why.
It's just the design delta, as they say in the biz, is getting wider. Just how far can you innovate on Windows anymore? It's just, but, you know, you need new versions of it to take into account, like, kind of micro trends in technology and fashion and like, big Uber trends in general industry direction. So they're going to keep updating the desktop regardless. Something else that was kind of interesting fairly recently was this little database company that bought some kind of obscure system server hardware, one of these software companies, Oracle and Sun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, some people out there started speculating that maybe if you see one software company buy a hardware company, maybe other software companies should buy hardware companies. Maybe people like Microsoft should start buying hardware companies, which it really is crazy talk now, isn't it?
Well, I have a lot of different opinions about this, but one thing I think that is a little bit crazy is just assuming now Microsoft's going to go out and buy some server vendor because Oracle did this. I'm one of those people who think Microsoft would have been way more worried if IBM bought Sun than they are that Oracle bought Sun. But that said, you can never say never. I mean, Microsoft does make its own hardware in a couple of cases, as we know, with Xbox. They made their own Zunes, and
It's a kind of qualified support for hardware, though, isn't it? They still let other people build the stuff. They kind of control the overall experience package, but they don't actually do any manufacturing themselves.
And I think that'll be the case too, maybe going forward with phones and things like that. But I actually was very intrigued by, well, I read a lot of different things that people thought about what Microsoft should think about the whole buy, and Ballmer saying, "I don't know what to think," basically, which was kind of funny when he was first presented with the idea. Like, I got to think about that. But a lot of people have been thinking about it. People who are, database specialists and people who have done a lot of work around SQL Server have been thinking a lot about it. And one of the people who I've been reading on this is Andrew Brust. He's one of Microsoft's regional directors for New York, somebody I know pretty well. And he wrote a really good blog post about this, kind of saying, people should be kind of worried about this with Microsoft, who work with Microsoft technologies, because people who say that Oracle's just the high-end database vendor and Microsoft gets all the rest of the market to themselves, that's just kind of a crazy view. And that if you look where Microsoft's going next with SQL Server Project Madison, they're doing a lot of what it sounds like Oracle's going to do, which is build a data center appliance.
And that's what they do. That and this comes back to the point about them not buying a hardware company. They will partner strategically with the people who do have the hardware experience. Now they're not going to ignore the fact they're not ignoring what Oracle and Sun are doing, but they're going to do what they do, which is to partner with the hardware companies. And in this case, I mean they're partnering with Ball, Dell, and Unisys. There are some big mainframe kind of style. Companies. I mean, it's either these like the Death Stars of mainframe systems. Really, these guys. I mean, they know big iron.
The question that keeps coming back among people who are in the Microsoft camp is Oracle really going to keep the hardware business, or is that something they're just going to dump? And same question about Solaris. What are their intentions with an operating system? Are they going to keep it? Are they going to, pull out different features and integrate them into database and then dump the rest? Nobody really knows at this point because it's so early.
I think what you can probably see is there's elements there in the Sun software portfolio, if you look beyond just the hardware, but in the open source stuff around storage and ZFS in Solaris and Open Solaris, that Oracle definitely likes the look of, and which it can use to build these own data appliances that it launched and has been talking about, the Exadata storage server and the Oracle Database Machine. Those open source components will mean high scale, high availability at a very low stroke free cost, which mean more overhead, which mean more kind of like profit margin for Microsoft. So I think you're going to see it at least exploit those assets. Now, whether that means it becomes a hardware company, I really don't think. I think they're still going to spin it out. They're going to take what is a kind of a very overburdened, bureaucratic, and struggling business, and spin out the hardware. But they will also live off the Solaris revenues because nothing makes money like maintenance.
Going back to Brust's post, Andrew Brust's post, which is on brustblog.com, if anybody wants to read the whole thing, he also points out that this is a new interesting twist for Microsoft with Azure. Because, Microsoft Azure, it's a platform, but then they've also talked about the pieces that run on top of Azure, right? Like they've talked about SharePoint hosted on Azure and CRM hosted on Azure. And he says, Microsoft has a lot more to reckon with than it did before on that front, even though Oracle said it doesn't want to play in the cloud. And that's because Microsoft has its own CRM, but Oracle has Siebel and PeopleSoft and JD Edwards and Oracle Financials. So it's going to be a lot more interesting now with this new matchup, I think.
Well, it's Oracle almost becomes like IBM in terms of their big systems focus, and they're becoming like IBM in terms of a big kind of like center of gravity in terms of the amount of software it provides. And it's like IBM also in terms of like they can go into a customer and go, okay, okay, you don't want to buy Oracle Financials, we can give you PeopleSoft Financials, you know, or, you know, if you don't like our application server, we can give you this open source application server, or, you know, or this open source database. Right now, so they've now got like increasing a disparate palette of tools that they can offer the customer, which is precisely what IBM does through global services. So the question is, what does Microsoft do to kind of counter this kind of palette? What can it give you anything other than just Windows and .NET all the way through? You know, the classic, you know, the answer is Windows and .NET. Now, what's the question?
Yeah, right. I mean, because, you know, Microsoft has consulting services and they have a ton of partners who they sell services through and with. But, yeah, it's a little bit different. You know, the other question, and I'm sure you have a lot to say about this, Gavin, because you write about this a lot, is Java. And, you know, what's this going to mean for the future of Java? And what's it going to mean for, you know, competing with Silverlight? I mean, there's a whole bunch of other side things to think about that probably weren't really on the radar screen before, now that Oracle's part of this.
Yeah, I think you're going to see Java continue. I mean, a lot of people are in agreement that Java is a bit like Windows. Enterprise Java has gone about as far as it can. There's nothing new to add to it. The heat these days is in the open source Java frameworks. I think that's where the excitement is. And those are the things that are kind of taking money away from Oracle. So it'll be interesting to see how Microsoft responds to those particular things, you know, via .NET or through some of the work it's doing on open source. But I don't think you're not going to see Java go away against .NET, because it's Oracle's own vested interest to keep maintaining Oracle, because its middleware is built squarely on Java.
Yeah, the other of course big question is MySQL and what happens with that. You know, I've seen some people speculating Oracle will kill off MySQL. I don't see that at all.
No, not at all.
No, that was
one of the reasons they bought the company.
Yeah, I mean, this gives them like a really awesome play against SQL Server now, right? Because Microsoft's big pitch when you talk about Oracle is they're so expensive, they're so high end. But now they cover way more of the database market, down to the level of Microsoft's lower end SQL Server SKUs.
Yeah, I mean, Oracle has always struggled on its open source middleware strategy. I mean, it let JBoss slip through its fingers. But, you know, to be fair to Oracle, and it's hard, but they have kept the open source projects going, like InnoDB, and they've kept SleepyCat going as well. I mean, again, it plays the IBM model, which is like, okay, you don't like Oracle's big old database, then we've got like this perfectly sized little open source database over here you can use instead. The only thing is, I mean, that's going to piss off the MySQL hardcore fans and those who really believed in the fact that MySQL was going places outside of the web and embedded and was going into the enterprise, because it's only at the enterprise that Oracle's going to cut MySQL off at the knees and really insist that customers buy its database rather than MySQL.
You know, I'd love to hear their opinion on this whole thing around MySQL is Sam Ramji from Microsoft, because, you know, that whole division at Microsoft that's reaching out to the open source community, they've been reaching out a lot to MySQL, right? I mean, the goal of Microsoft is to turn LAMP into WAMP, I always joke, you know, with Linux being replaced by Windows. And, you know, that it's going to be interesting to see now, can they keep partnering or trying to partner with MySQL now that Oracle owns it?
So on to the Steve Ballmer Mood Index, MJ. What mood is Steve-O in this week?
Well, you know, if the Microsoft earnings had been worse, I think I would say throwing chairs, but they weren't as bad as a lot of Wall Street expected, and their stock really didn't get dinged. So I'd just say he's kind of in a pensive mood this week.
Really?
What do you think?
I'd say he's not intense. He's probably all business. I mean, you know, it's the week, the economy. To quote Rumsfeld, is what it is, and I think that's why Wall Street was probably pretty reticent about it as well. They've been battered. They know the results can be bad. The only thing was the results could have been worse.
Yeah, I agree, and also, you know, they really emphasized during their earnings call that they've been doing a ton of cost cutting at Microsoft, not just cutting jobs, but cutting costs and putting people on travel restriction and doing all kinds of other things to save money. And I think that's one reason Wall Street was happy. And I think it's a sad reality for people who are longtime softies who've had a freer rein, but it's working, whatever that's worth, in the eyes of Wall Street.
Definitely, and they were actually ahead on costs as far as I kind of gathered from the conference call. Well, that was Mike Byte. I'm Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog. And this was Microbyte, brought to you by the people who bite the hand that feeds IT.